The following shiur is being recorded for TorahDownloads.com, a project of the Yehuda Mann Foundation, Le'ilui Nishmas Yehuda Aryeh ben Yoshua Yakir.
We spoke last time about the relationship of Jews and Goyim. Part of going out to the big world is meeting other people, and it becomes more of an acute issue, who they are, how we relate to them, and so on. The next one, logically, would be to discuss the different other movements within Judaism: Reform, Conservative, Zionism, Reconstruction, etc., the attitudes, the reasons, and so on. I want to speak about something else, being that this is kind of a live series, so things that happen and come up, I do feel, I guess, I don't know, not the word entitled, but I feel sometimes that I ought to speak about things as they happen, as they pertain to us. So there are two things that came up recently, and one of them pertains to something that we specifically, that I was specifically asked to speak about, and one of them is a topic that we've done before, but it's just fascinating. A young man came to me last night. He was brought by Rabbi Karevsky from the University of Maryland, a very, very sweet boy, in conservative type of background, positive about Judaism in general, minimal education, and to supplement his Jewish education, he's been taking Judaic studies at the University of Maryland in an effort to help understand Yiddishkeit better. The professor, who he told me is a very, very learned woman who really knows her stuff, has instead been basically taking shots at the Chumash and showing all the loopholes and showing how it obviously was patched together from a lot of different documents, etc., and therefore it's riddled with internal contradictions, repetitions, different ways of calling the same thing, and so on and so forth. So he asked me if I could help him. He said a lot of people in the class are a bit angry, and he asked me if I could help him with some of the things that he's pointed out that made a very strong impression on him, and so on. I told him, I'll try, I don't know. And he presented three issues, which I thought were fascinating. The first one, he said, is when God created man, he said, read the verse in Hebrew. It says, Na'ase Adam, let us make man. Why, if we believe in one God, why would it say, let us make man? Obviously, it was edited at a time when there were still very strong polytheistic beliefs, and this was something that was done either to help people agree to it, people wouldn't accept just outright the idea of one God, and so on. It was kind of stunning to me that there was no mention that this question has been around, by all counts, at least 2,000 years in the Medrash and Rashi. I said, did she mention there are other approaches? And she said, no, this was a very obvious point that she found, and which indicates the polytheistic era of the Jewish people, and it's sort of merging into monotheistic. So I showed him Rashi, and I told him Rashi addresses that issue, and Rashi is built on Chazal. Most of Rashi built on Chazal, this one also. That means that for 2,000 years, this question had been there, and it had been addressed. And Rashi says it's there to teach us that there are herets, that a person, even if he can do it himself, and if he's bigger, should consult the smaller person. And Rashi says, and even though the apikorsim will, even though the minim, it's nasim makam lirdas, but they'll be able to use it, the Torah still said, I'd rather take the risk and teach their herets, and rather than caution, which is fascinating. You hear somebody 2,000 years later using it, not even referring to it. I told him before we went further, I said, let me explain something to you. The Chumash itself is a very incomplete document. You're right. There are contradictions. There are petitions. There are holes there. There are bits and pieces missing. And that itself, I said, it had it been the work of a human editor, the editor would be considered to be poor. It's a poorly edited work. If there was an editor, if there was this redactor, I said, a not too bright college kid could do a lot better job in editing an intelligible and readable document. I told him, it's like if you ever see these films, these slides that are meant to be 3D and you're supposed to see two of them, if you look at one of them, it's strange. It doesn't quite look right, hazy. If you look at these movies that are supposed to be 3D movies without those glasses, they look fuzzy. And when you put the glasses on, it comes into perspective. I said, it's exactly what the Torah is. Reading it as a literal document, not understanding the second half to it, will give you a picture of mediocrity and redundancy and contradiction. And I couldn't even say there was an editor. I would say just slop together. Doesn't, you know, it's too many glaring pieces. The second thing he asked me was, well, look at the first two chapters of Genesis. The first chapter has a very structured chronological order of creation, and it's first comes the heavens, and then comes the waters, and then comes the light, the water, etc. And then in the second chapter, it starts with really everything being around man, and you know, it sort of works its way backwards. It's man, and then he brings out the animals, and then he puts in a garden for the sake of man, and so on. So I told him, well, let's imagine a person is watching a documentary, and there are in this documentary, we have two, not the word is shots, but two pieces. The first one, you're training a camera on the ground. You're training a camera on a city block, and demolition crew comes, raises all the buildings. A while later, a crew comes and digs big holes. And then a while later, somebody puts up a building, and at the end of that clip, you have 20,000 people coming into a housing complex and living in these buildings. Which, by the way, is something that I witnessed. I lived across the street from a huge housing project in New York when I was a little kid, and I would watch them day after day raising city blocks on city blocks, digging, building. It kept us occupied for years until we actually moved into those buildings. Now, in the same documentary, there's a second clip, and there's a fellow standing with a committee, housing committee, whatever committee you want, and he's presenting a vision of a whole city with 20,000 people living in decent conditions, and parks, and commuting to jobs, and a whole pain. And people raise questions. Well, you know, how are you going to have enough land for it? Oh, we're going to raise this and raise that. How are we going to get electricity and water? We'll have to extend the pipes. How are we going to get the subway, extend the rail, etc.? And he would be seeing the same thing backwards. Now, which is true? The answer is they're both true, each one coming from a very different perspective. So if you look at the dry creation, well, it was light, you know, water, greenery, animals, and man. If you look at the committee, the Naas Adam committee, there's this vision of man who is really the purpose of creation, and in order to have man, he needs a place to be, and that's the Gan Eden, and so on and so forth. So I don't know, but those two chapters are perfect, in perfect sync, and they're giving us two pictures of creation, and together they give us the real picture: creation as from the point of view of intention, creation from the point of view of implementation. Those are perfectly in sync. Then he asked me a third question, which I didn't have an answer to. So he asked me in the story with Rivka and Eliezer, which is interesting enough, this week's parsha. It says that Eliezer was told to find a girl from the family, from the Haim, as he said, and he went there, he made this test. She passed the test. He right away gave her a bunch of bracelets and stuff, and then he and you know, and then he asked her who she is, and she said, "Oh, I'm a girl from that family," and he was very happy. When he tells over that story, he doesn't tell it over exactly that way. He says, I asked her, you know, she brought the water, and then I asked her who you are, and she said, I'm Bissell's daughter, and said, oh, Mazel Tov, here's the jewelry and stuff like that. So how come he changed, how come the story's changed? So I told him, so I didn't know, and I took a look, and lo and behold, Rashi asked it. Shina Haseda, the order was changed, because before it says that he gave first, then he asked. He said because he kind of fudged it, Eliezer, because he was scared that Psul would ask him, hey, I mean, had you known that she was the girl you were looking for? Avram made a very important condition. His condition was that she be of the family. So the fact that, so Eliezer actually fudged it in order to do it. So those are 3 points that he raised and he answered. I thanked him that it helped me realize, I said, I've been learning Chumash and Rashi since I was a small kid, and you don't even realize how it reads without Rashi. And Rashi, not only has his own, in his own right, but Rashi is representing Chazal and the Torah. And all of a sudden you realize there's a lot missing and so on. I once heard it described extremely picturesque by Reb Leibel Kellerman. He's a person who wrote Permission to Believe, Permission to Receive, and so on. So I once heard him in one of his lectures. He said when he started becoming frum in UCLA, I forgot exactly the circumstances that brought him, I just don't remember, but he said he got out, he went himself and bought a Bible, he taught himself to read Hebrew, he learned how to read Hebrew, and he began to learn the Chumash, and he realized that the text was very corrupted. There were a lot of grammatical mistakes, there were a lot of inconsistencies and holes, and he figured the university has a very poor edition of it, and he, you know, and he couldn't find any edition that really had it correct. And then, I don't know how he happened to be on Rashi, and he realized that Rashi seemed to have thought of every question that he would have. But it's important to realize that Torah stands only with the two together. Without that, as a literal document, without any explanation to it, it really is noticeably missing and sloppy and so on. And for us, it reaffirms the two. And it also, I found it amazing that a woman who's a professor in college, she's an older person, she's not a youngster, she's somebody who's really, you know, who knows stuff, wouldn't even mention that for 2,000 years Jews have a tradition about it. She could knock it, she could say she doesn't like it, she doesn't believe it, or whatever it is, but not to, just to walk in, to present this material to college kids and say, I have found the discrepancies in the Bible and it's, you know, and I've realized how wrong it is. It seemed to me a height of intellectual dishonesty or rank amoratus. I told him, I said, either your professor is extraordinarily ignorant or extremely dishonest. I don't have a problem if we present and say, I think these answers are not right, I think they're apologetics, I think this, I think that. But not to present something when that the, this is a question that's been following us all along, you know, for the earliest recorded memory of Klal Yisrael's Torah, I found it to be an extraordinary experience. That is one point. It happened last night, and I felt I'd like to share it, because it touched on a bunch of things we've said before. I'd like to go to a completely different topic, which we have. This is built around a question that was asked on the sheet that I was given. The question was, why were the rabbis so, why are there so many chumris upon chumris about chumris and so on and so forth? I want to also introduce you with a story that I was a part of it, and therefore, you know, it's always good when real life comes into play. Somebody spoke to me. A younger man, this is somebody who's a Ben Torah, learned in Yeshiva quite a few years. I wouldn't say he personifies a Lakewood person in terms of, he's not fakvetched, he's a man of the world, he's pleasant to interact with, he's graceful, he has social graces, and, you know, very, very pleasant person. And recently has gone to work at a decent job, at a professional job, a respectable professional job. And he spoke to me and he was very distressed. He said, an incident sort of, or situation happened in the office, in the context of the office work, where had I not been scared of a picture of me in all the newspapers with a great word scandal on top of it with a big S, I don't know how far I would have gone. And, like, how could it be? I mean, I've been in yeshiva so many years, I'm frum, I'm a ben Torah, and klum, none of it would have withstood the test, except for the fact that I'm a student of to realize the public humiliation. The job itself is a type of job of trust, and to be involved in some affair and, you know, would have actually blown up, and, you know, it would have ended my professional career, my marriage and everything with it, and that's why the person at least had enough seichel to do it. And the person was sort of very shaken, possibly like sort of not believing himself anymore and so on. That was the situation. Now, there's a Gemara in Kedushin Pei Aleph. So even the people that kind of learn a lot of the Kiyas, sort of ends in a Sechta, and people don't get up to it. And, you know, and that's why it's something that may or may not even make it onto the radar screen. The Gemara goes through it's the Agarata that deals with the issues of Yichud. So Chazal will go there Yichud, and you know, the Gemara brings a whole bunch of situations of Amoraim that were involved that were very, very, let's put it this way, they felt or they were on the verge of doing something very wrong. Now, Chazal go through situations where it says that there was Reb Amram Chasida. Chazal called this person Reb Amram Chasida. Reb Amram the Tzaddik. Chazal determined that, and they said that he took a he had them sleep in a loft, and there was this very, very heavy ladder that needed a few people to lift it, and he at night he took it away so nobody could go up. At night he happened to notice one of the women there, and he was so turned on, he grabbed the ladder. It said it would have needed a few people, 10 people would have been needed to carry it, and he just picked it up and ran with it. As he got halfway up, he sort of caught himself, and he started yelling, "Fire, fire!" And people came running, and they said, "Oh, you've embarrassed us. What an embarrassing situation. I mean, you've been caught sort of in a very compromising situation." And he said, "Well, I'd rather be humiliated in this world rather than you should be embarrassed with me from the world to come." They have different stories of other Amoraim where they were almost nichshal. It says that somebody would ask for that somebody should watch over him when he was near animals. Now, as a side remark, it's not as crazy as we think it is. I know from somebody who was involved a bit, and he told me people who work with livestock and don't have human contact for long periods of time, it becomes an outlet for them, and it's not uncommon. So this is somebody who was, this I heard from somebody who worked once, this is many, many years ago, he worked with a Baal Tshuva from the Colorado area, and this person was on a ranch, and he said, you know, it's when you're away for long stretches of time, so an animal becomes a substitute. And so on. And the Gemara goes through a whole bunch of series of people that were doing a very so on. So the first point is the human body is built with tremendous kohos of taiva. Freud was not all wrong when he said that this is the primary mover of a person. And these energies and these kohos drive a person. And a person should acknowledge it, that nothing that he's done has killed it. It's normal, and that's why Chazal said that a person needs, there is almost no amount of shmira enough on himself. The two broad shmiras are yichud. In other words, don't stop at a step before. don't ever be in a situation where the question is, should I not? Reb Chaim Shulevitz once put it very well. He said, it says that by Yosef HaTzadik, by Kriyas Yamsuf, it says, Hayom Roa Vayonos, the Yam saw Klai saw coming, they ran away. Chazal asked, what did they see that it ran away? So it says that Aronos or Yosef Keneged the Vayonos Achutza. So Reb Chaim asked, why was that schar for Vayonos Achutza? Vayonos Achutza seemed to be he ran away from the test instead of facing it head on. Reb Chaim Shavit said, the test of Arayas is not will you do it, won't you do it. The test is will you allow yourself to get into the situation or not. Because once you're in the situation, it's almost nothing you could do. The saying is don't allow yourself to be in a situation where Arayas is easy to come by. Yichud means that you're one step away from it being possible. And after Chazal also makan Yichud. The second thing is, Chazal said that you're not allowed to darshan Shalom Ha'isha. Now, in today's, the translation of that, you could say, hello, how are you, how are things? There's a very sharp line between what's considered conventional social nothingness, the type of stuff that you just say pro forma to everybody, oh, how are you? Oh, glad to hear. Very nice. Happy. No, that's today for us, that means nothing. There's an old joke that the definition of a nudnik is someone that you ask him how things are, and he actually tells you. It's the polite, fine, good, and even in a workplace where you're working with somebody, as long as the conversation is focused on tachlis, and that's that. It's also not, a deep involved conversation on tachlis, like, if you work on a case, or you're working on a drawing or whatever it is, but the conversations that lead to a deeper emotional connection, understanding of a person, fall under that getter. So for a person to be involved and to ask, well, how are things going? I see you very stressed out. What's on your mind? What's on your heart? That's a big, big red line. Men and women are built to connect emotionally, and they draw each other, and that's where we are. That's not a perversion. That's the way we're built to be. And the place to stop is before, not before. And that's why when Chazal put different shmiras into place, Chazal understood human nature only too well. Human nature has not changed terribly a lot. I don't think our taiva appetites have gotten smaller from when Chazal came out. And same thing with all other areas, even the smaller areas, like Shabbos and Muktzah and stuff like that. Chazal looked at the basic human nature. When you make a line, for instance, keeping the law is understood as being very important in law-abiding society. But if you were to tell a judge, I didn't think that the reason for the law applied in my case, even if the person is right, the counter logic would be, if you treat the law as an absolute, then it's binding and it has the power to keep society straight and in structure. If you don't do it that way, if you keep each time clearing a hakira, why was this law legislated and for what reason does it apply to me, then at the end of the day, you will break everything. The shmira of Chazal lies in obeying it to the letter. Even if you say, well, it's not nogea, first of all, you don't know. And secondly, even if it were true, but you've breached the fence. And once you've breached it, everything else falls apart. So I knew somebody at Talmud Chacham, who decided to play with fire. And, he had a weakness for this stuff, and he started discarding Rabbanans because he felt that they were not justified, and so on and so forth. And the person was a very, very bright person, actually, and a person who had issues, obviously. It was kind of a... And, he was actually living with the doraisas and avoiding all the rabbanans that were begetter shmira and gzeir and so on and so forth. He lived with a goy in an apartment, actually, and kept his dishes and anything that was not. At the end of the day, is obviously he's gone completely. But the shmira of Chazal is that it's absolute, and this is certain. And Chazal put, and if it's not to get me today, it'll be to get tomorrow, and so on. But especially in the other areas, especially in Arayas, which is first of all today's generation. It used to be that since society had a taboo on it, it wasn't as easy to move forward with it. There was resistance on the other side. You were looked upon askance and so on. Today, since society itself presents almost no restrictions on it, it's not socially taboo. Bear in mind that this person said his only thing that kept him going was because since his profession was a kind of profession of trust, it would have been seen as a misuse of trust and so on, and it would have let him down. But the fear of punishment is a very, very powerful deterrent. There is no fear of punishment today because most situations it's seen as being okay, forgivable, certainly in the outside world. So we have a lot more, a lot bigger need to keep those smears. And the two big things is Hilchus Yichud, apply, and as much as a person can get out of situations where he has to work in intimate relationship with a woman, there's another place, and I guess this is more of a practical point, that there are two reasons why this situation comes up and creates issues. One is, it says, I'll quote a Rashi by Ifastor. It says that the reason why she has to sit 30 days in Mimis Abel is because he should see her benivlusa, how she looks down. She's sitting, her hair disheveled, her nails not trimmed, crying and depressed and really kind of looking not the best, and see his wife looking the best, and hopefully that will dissuade him from being swayed by the Fastor. The opposite happens to be true in workplace relationships versus home. Your wife, any normal person at home, is comfortable rather than attractive. The person doesn't want to walk around made up and dressed up. You want to be comfortable. You also want to be comfortable in your home, and you want to wear slippers, and you want to wear whatever it is, something more casual. So the woman also wears like that, and she's busy with the kids, and busy with the cooking. And you see a woman not at her best. When you go to the workplace, just like your wife, when she goes to her workplace, is dressed nicely and meshlach and is smiling and is certainly functioning, you see a woman who looks like that. And the contrast sometimes becomes difficult to cope with. Even though Seichel says that this other woman, once she'll be home, would look the same exact thing. That's the way it is. People have their appearance mode and their comfort mode. And when a woman's in a comfort mode, and when your hair is quote-unquote let down, you yell, you scream, you're with the kids and they're all over the place and you're stressed out and so on. It's a problem. And recognize there's no easy solution. Chazal have, mentioned that the woman should be dressed always pleasantly and so on. But at the end of the day, there's reality there. So you will always be mushba by that. That's one element that's very important. And there's a second element, and this has a lot to do with human nature. The world, there's an old Yiddish joke. I guess Yiddish jokes have a lot of common sense wisdom. Somebody once came to a Rav, and he said, Rabbi, it was a Yiddish joke, I want to get divorced. So he said, why? So he starts hemming and hawing, and the Rav says, tell me the truth, is there another woman involved? And he said, is there a different woman involved? And he said, yes, Rabbi. He said, is she nicer than your wife? He said, no. Is she wealthier, smarter than your wife? No. Is she prettier than your wife? No. So why do you want to drop your wife and marry her? He said, because she's a different one. In other words, the mechanism of taiva. It's true about taiva zachila also. I once heard from a woman, elderly woman from Europe. She was one of the few girls in her town in Kletsk. She actually grew up in Kletsk, who came from a well-to-do family, and her mother would bake cake and cookies. They'd be made with eggs and with cream and with sugar and with raisins and kol molded the tavusa. The other girls in the class had cookies made out of flour, water, and sugar. And she would always come home and tell her mother, why don't you get a recipe from this lady? They make such good cookies. And her mother would laugh. You know, her cookies had cream and sugar and eggs and everything good in it. And this other cookie was nothing, but it was different. You know, the new, the different, is what tingles a person. It creates a sensation of expectation. It creates a taiva. That's the way we're built. The familiar loses its taiva, and that's just like drugs. Whatever dosage you become used to, you need something more and different to trip you up, to get you high. So the woman at the office. If people always think that if they'll marry, one of the rationales I've heard is that people look for a very, very attractive wife that will keep you away from harm. I assure you it doesn't, and I have a very simple raya. Hollywood people are supposed to be the most glamorous people, and the most dissatisfied, I don't know if they're dissatisfied with the marriage, maybe they're just kind of sort of disposable marriages and they don't expect to be together more than a year or two, but the most glamorous people are married, have been married to 8-9 glamorous women and still going strong. I mean, those are official marriages, forget about everything else. There is no satisfying taiva. It's obviously somebody who's starved, somebody who's single, halacha restricts from many functions, many jobs. Obviously, some measure of satisfaction is very important, and you know, it's something that you need to think about it, and you need to realize the reasonable satisfaction of a person. It's something actually Rabbi Hafa spoke about quite openly, and there was a kenis of tznius for men. And understanding this, it's an important part of the picture. Yes. But no matter how satisfied, no matter how gorged you'll be on taiva, and possibly even the more you're gorged, that is not a shmira. The shmira lies the many gdorim that Chazal gave us. If a person goes towards literature, today literature is, I guess, is a euphemism for internet, that excites and arouses a person, it pushes his expectations, and it makes him more desperate. The shmiras that Chazal gave us were shmiras on a practical level, so that if you move 2, 3, 4 steps back, so at least if you push one step, you know that there's a safety net to a safety net to a safety net, and understanding the processes that lie behind it. If a person psychologically can say to himself, the reason why this woman seems so attractive to me is simply because she's not my wife. In the situations that my wife would be in, she would probably look a lot worse and be a lot worse. It's just a meaningless fantasy. It helps a lot when to dampen a person's enthusiasm when a person can reduce it. And a person who doesn't let himself go emotionally past a certain line is also very important. So it's a cordial, formal relationship, that's what it is. You know, it's formal, it's cordial, it's respectful, but it doesn't carry the elements of what schok is and all those elements that Chazal pointed out that lead to arayas. It's not to a person's shame, and that's why Chazal, I think, went through all these things, pointing out how very big people were nizher and suspected themselves. It's not a shame. The shame lies in not watching yourself. It doesn't lie in what your taivas are. The taivas, your nature of taivas, Akash Baruch put in you. We don't have control over that. And even if, quote unquote, even if a person thinks it's perverted, that's something to be ashamed of. That's the given. This is whatever it is. This is in me. My question is, what am I doing about it? If it needs to be treated, get it treated. If it needs shmiras more than anybody else, then make those shmiras. That's your avoda. Your avoda is not to ask why they have crazy taivas or such a strong taivas or whatever it is. So never be in a situation where you come close to being compromised. It'd be 2, 3, 4 steps away from that. That's all. It's like anything that's dangerous, you put more and more safety nets around it and you keep away from it. The keeping just the basic halachas and understanding how to apply it is probably the best shmira in this area. I don't know if it's on topic because people have asked about it. It's not in the seder we went, but I just feel again. I have a feeling that when I'm involved in real life situation, it helps bring it home. It's one thing when you preach it as an abstract possibility. It's another thing when somebody who's very serious about Torah, a really good person, and a person who would obviously be a very attractive person, a person I can understand people would gravitate to, kind of come up with these issues and face them very honestly. And I wanted to share it. Okay.